calm down and give the reason for calling this meeting. Lucius rather enjoyed the little scene before him. Obviously, Rhaefar, the great braggart, had been cut down to size in his meeting with the strong man. Lucius could hardly keep a hideous smirk off his face.
"Wouldn't the little angel tell you where you could find this, what was that name again?"
Lucius asked, knowing full well Tal's name.
"Tal!"
Rhaefar roared, and Lucius could detect Rhaefar's humiliation at the very sound of the name.
"The little angel, the helpless little angel, told you nothing?"
Rhaefar's immediate response was a monstrous black fist clamped instantly around Lucius's throat.
"Do you mock me, little imp?"
Lucius had learned the right tone of grovelling to please this tyrant.
"Oh, be not offended, great one. I only seek your pleasure."
"Then seek this Tal,"
Rhaefar growled. He released Lucius and turned to all the other demons present.
"All of you, seek this Tal. I want him in my hands to shred him at my pleasure. This battle could be settled easily between the two of us. Find him. Bring me word."
Lucius tried to hide his words behind a whimpering tone, but they were especially selected for another purpose.
"Indeed we shall, great one. But surely this Tal must be a formidable foe to have routed you at the fall of Babylon. Whatever will you do should we find him? Will you dare to assail him again?"
Rhaefar grinned, his fangs shining.
"You will see what your Baal can do."
"And may we not see what this Tal can do?"
Rhaefar drew close to Lucius and stared him down with fiery yellow orbs.
"When I have vanquished this Tal and hurled his little pieces across the skies as my victory banner, I will most certainly give you your chance to better me. I will relish every moment of it."
Rhaefar turned away, and for an instant the whole room was filled with his black wings before he shot upward through the building and into the sky. For hours afterwards, as angels all over Ashton watched from their hiding places, the Baal flew slowly over the town like a sinister vulture, his sword visible and challenging. Up, down, back and forth he flew, weaving in among the downtown buildings, then soaring high above the town in graceful arcs. Down below, through the window of an obscure store basement, Sion watched as Rhaefar passed overhead again. He turned to his captain, who sat nearby on some appliance crates with Gylo, Triskal, and Mota. Triskal, with the help of others, was getting himself patched up and back together again.
"I don't understand," said Sion. "What's he think he's doing?"
Tal looked up from Triskal's wounds and said matter-of-factly, "He's trying to draw me out." Mota added, "He wants the captain. Apparently he has offered great honors to whatever demon can find Captain Tal and report his whereabouts." Gylo said gruffly, "The devils are crawling all over the church with no other aim. It was the first place they looked." Tal anticipated Sion's next question and answered it. "Signa and the others are still there at the church. We've tried to keep our guard there looking as it usually does." Sion watched Rhaefar circle over the far side of the town and come back for another pass.
"I'd have trouble being taunted by such as him."
Tal spoke the truth without shame. "If I were to meet him now, I would most certainly lose, and he knows it. Our prayer cover is insufficient, while he has all the backing he needs." They could all hear the rushing of Rhaefar's huge leathery wings and see his shadow fall over the building for an instant as he passed overhead. "We will all have to be very, very careful." Hank was walking through the town again, up and down the streets and storefronts, driven by the Lord and praying with every step he took. He had a feeling that God had some particular purpose for this little jaunt, but he couldn't begin to guess what it was. Creone and Triskal walked on either side of him. They had gotten some extra reserves to stay at the house and watch over Mary. They were wary and alert. And Triskel, still recovering from his recent encounter with Rhaefar, felt especially edgy when he considered where they were leading Hank. Hank took a turn he had never taken before, down a street he had never looked at before, and finally stopped outside a business establishment he had only heard bad stories about but could never find. He stood outside the door, staring, amazed at the number of kids going in and out like bees. Finally, he stepped inside. Creoni and Triskel tried their very best to look meek and unthreatening as they followed him. The cave was aptly named. The power it took to run the rows upon rows of flickering, beeping video games was made up for by the total absence of any other lights, except a little blue globe here and there in the black ceiling with an occasional watt meandering through it. There was more sound than light. Heavy metal rock music pounded from speakers all around the room and clashed painfully with the myriads of electronic sounds tumbling out of the machines. One lone proprietor sat behind his little cash register in the corner, reading a girly magazine whenever he wasn't making change for the game players. Hank had never seen so many quarters in one place. Here were kids of all ages with few other places to go, congregating after school and all through the weekends to hang out, hang on, play games, pair up, wander off, do drugs, do sex, do whatever. Hank knew this place was a hellhole. It wasn't the machines or the decor or the dimness. It was just the pungent spiritual stench of demons having their heyday. He felt sick to his stomach. Creoni and Triskel could see hundreds of narrowing yellow eyes peering at them from the corners and dark hiding places of the room. Already they had heard several metallic rings as blades were drawn and made ready. "Do I look harmless enough?" Triskel quietly asked. "They do not think you are harmless anymore," Creoni said dryly. The two looked around at all the eyes looking back at them. They smiled in a truce-like way, raising their empty hands to show no intent of hostility. The demons made no reply, but several blades could be seen glowing in the dark. "So, where is Seth?" Triskel asked. "On his way, I'm sure." Triskel tensed. Creoni followed his look to see a surly demon approaching them. The demon's hand was on his sword. He hadn't drawn it, but plenty of other swords were drawn behind him. The black spirit looked the two angels up and down and hissed, "You are not welcome here. What is your business?" Creoni answered quickly and politely, "We are watching over the man of God." The demon took one look at Hank and lost the better portion of his cockiness. "Bush!" he exclaimed nervously, while those behind him backed away. "What is he doing here?" "That's nothing we wish to discuss," said Triskel. The demon only sneered.
"Are you Triskel?"
"I am." The demon laughed, coughing up puffs of red and yellow.
"You enjoy a fight, don't you?"
Several demons joined him in laughter. Triskel had no intention of answering. The demon had no time to demand an answer. Suddenly, all the mocking spirits grew tense and agitated. Their eyes darted about, and then, like a flock of timid birds, they backed away and huddled in the dark corners. At the same time, Creoni and Triskel could feel a new strength coursing through them. They looked down at Hank. He was praying. "Dear Lord," he said silently, "help us to reach these kids. Help us to touch their lives." Hank was praying at a very good time, considering the commotion just coming in the back door. As demons slinked away from the entrance, three of their comrades came into the building, wailing, hissing, and drooling, their arms and wings over their heads. They were chased and prodded along by a very tall and quite unshakable angelic warrior. "Well," said Triskel, "Seth has brought us Ron Forsyth, and then some."
"I was afraid of that," said Creoni.
Triskel was referring to a young man barely visible under the three demons, a very confused and disoriented victim of their destructive influence. They clung to him like leeches, causing him to stagger to and fro as they fought to avoid the goading tip of the big warrior's sword. Seth had them under very tight control, however, and he herded them right toward Hank Bush. "Hey, Ron," said some guys at a bombardier game. "Hey," was all Ron answered, giving them a slow, heavy wave of his hand. He didn't seem very happy. Hank heard the name and saw Ron Forsythe coming, and for a moment he didn't know whether to remain where he was or get out of harm's way. Ron was a tall, spindly youth with long, unkempt hair, dirty T-shirt and jeans, and eyes that seemed to be looking into some other universe. He staggered toward Frank, looking over his shoulder as if a flock of birds was chasing him, and then forward as if he were one step from a cliff. Hank, watching him approach, decided to remain right where he was. If the Lord wanted the two of them to meet, well, it was about to happen. Then Ron stopped short and leaned against a road racing game. This man standing in front of him looked familiar. The demons clinging to Ron were shaking and whimpering, shooting glances toward Seth behind them and Creoni and Triskal in front of them. As for the other demons in the room, they were itching for a fight. Their yellow eyes shifted about and their red blades clattered, but something held them back. That praying man. "Hi there," Hank said to the young man. "I'm Hank Bush." Ron's glassy eyes widened. He stared at Hank and said with slurred speech, "I've seen you around. You're that preacher my folks keep talking about." Hank was sure enough now to guess. "Ron? Ron Forsythe?" Ron looked around and fidgeted as if he'd been caught doing something illegal. "Yeah." Hank stretched out his hand. "Well, God bless you, Ron. I'm glad to meet you." The three demons snarled at that, but the three warriors shifted their weight forward just a little and kept them under control. "Divination," said Triskal, identifying one of the demons. Divination clung to Ron with needle-sharp talons and hissed,
"And what is your business with us?"
"The lad," said Creoni.
"You can't tell us what to do,"
another demon squawked, its fist stubbornly clenched. "Rebellion?" Creoni asked. The demon did not deny it.
"He belongs to us."
The spirits in the room were getting braver, moving in closer.
"Let's get him out of here," said Creoni.
Hank touched Ron on the shoulder and said, "Can we step outside where we can visit for a minute?" Divination and Rebellion spoke together.
"What for?"
Ron protested.
"What for?"
Hank just led him gently.
"Come on."
And they went out the back door. Triskal remained in the doorway, his hand on his sword. Only the demons attached to Ron were allowed outside, constantly corralled by Seth and Creoni. Ron sank onto a nearby bench like a rag doll in slow motion. Hank put his hand on Ron's shoulder and kept looking into those dazed eyes, wondering where to start.
"How are you feeling?" Hank finally asked.
The third demon enclosed Ron's head in his bulky, slimy arms. The boy's head drooped toward his chest and he almost nodded off, oblivious to Hank's words. The tip of Seth's sword got the demon's attention.
"What?"
it screeched.
"Sorcery?"
The spirit laughed drunkenly.
"All the time, more and more. He'll never give it up."
Ron started to chuckle, feeling drugged and silly. But Hank could feel something in his spirit, the same horrible presence he had felt that one very frightening night. Evil spirits in such a young boy.
"Lord, what can I do? What can I say?"
The Lord answered, and Hank knew what he had to do.
"Ron," he said, whether Ron heard him or not, "can I pray for you?"
Only Ron's eyes turned to look at Hank, and Ron actually pleaded,
"Yeah, pray for me, preacher."
But the demons wanted no part of that. They all cried into Ron's brain with one voice,
"No, no, no, you don't need that."
Ron suddenly stirred, his head rocked back and forth, and he mumbled,
"No, no, don't pray. I don't like that."
Now Hank wondered what Ron really wanted. Or was it even Ron who was speaking?
"I would like to pray for you, okay?"
Hank asked just to check.
"No, don't,"
Ron said and then pleaded.
Please pray. Come on.
Do it, Creoni prompted. Pray.
No,
the demons cried.
You can't make us leave him.
Pray, said Creoni.
Hank knew he had better take charge of the situation and pray for this boy. He already had his hand on Ron, so he started praying very gently.
Lord Jesus, I pray for Ron. Please touch him, Lord, and get through to his mind and set him free from these spirits that are hanging on to him.
The spirits clung to Ron like spoiled brats and whined at Hank's prayer. Ron moaned and shook his head some more. He tried to get up, then he sat down again and held Hank's arm. The Lord spoke to Hank again, and Hank had a name.
Sorcery, let go of him in the name of Jesus.
Ron squirmed on the bench and cried out as if struck with a knife. Hank thought Ron would squeeze his arm off. But sorcery obeyed. He whined and hollered and spit, but he obeyed, fluttering away into the nearby trees. Ron gave an anguished sigh and looked at Hank with eyes full of pain and desperation.
Come on, come on, you're doing it.
Hank was amazed. He took hold of Ron's hand just to assure him and kept looking into those eyes. They were clearer now. Hank could see an earnest, pleading soul looking back at him.
What next?
He asked the Lord. The Lord answered, and Hank had another name.
Divination?
Ron looked right at Hank, his eyes wild and his voice hoarse.
No, not me. Never.
But Hank didn't stop. He looked right into Ron's eyes and said,
Divination in Jesus' name. Let go.
No,
Ron protested, but then said just as quickly,
Go on, divination, get out. I don't want you with me anymore.
Divination grudgingly obeyed. Thanks to this praying man, oppressing Ron Forsythe wasn't fun anymore. Ron relaxed again, sniffing back some tears. Seth poked the last little demon.
How about you, Rebellion?
Rebellion was having trouble making up his mind. Ron could feel it.
Spirit, please go. I've had it with you.
Hank prayed the same thing.
Spirit, go. In the name of Jesus, leave Ron alone.
Rebellion considered Ron's words, looked at Seth's sword, looked at the praying man, and finally let go. Ron twitched as if having a terrible cramp, but then he said,
Yeah. Yeah, he's out.
Seth shooed the three demons away, and they fluttered back into the cave where they would be welcome and unhampered. Hank hung on to Ron's hand and waited, watching and praying until he knew what else to do. This was all so incredible, so fascinating, so frightening, but so necessary. This must be the Lord's lesson number two in spiritual combat. Hank knew he was learning something he would have to know to win this battle. Ron was changing before Hank's very eyes, relaxing, breathing easier, his eyes returning to a normal, down-to-earth gaze. Hank finally said a very soft, Amen, and asked,
Are you okay, Ron?
Ron answered right away,
Yeah, I feel better. Thanks.
He looked at Hank and smiled a weak, almost apologetic smile.
It's funny. No, it's neat. It was just today I was thinking I needed somebody to pray for me. I just couldn't go on with all the stuff I've been into.
Hank knew what had happened. It was the Lord, I think, who set it up.
Nobody's prayed for me before.
I know your folks do all the time.
Well, yeah, they do.
And the rest of us at the church, too. We're all pulling for you. Ron took his first clear-eyed look at Hank.
So you're my folks' pastor, huh? I thought you were older than that.
Not too much older, Hank quipped.
Are the other people at the church like you?
Hank chuckled. We're all just people. We have our good points and our bad points. But we all have Jesus. And he gives us a special love for each other.
They talked. They talked about school, the town, Ron's folks, drugs in general and particular, Hank's church, the Christians who were around, and Jesus. Ron began to notice that no matter what the subject or the issue, Hank had a way of bringing Jesus into it. Ron didn't mind. This wasn't like a phony sales pitch. Hank Bush really believed that Jesus was the answer to everything. So, after talking about everything else with Jesus brought into it, Ron let Hank talk about Jesus. Just Jesus. It wasn't dull. Hank could really get excited about him. Chapter 16 Nathan and Armoth flew high above the beautiful summer countryside following the speeding Buick. Things were definitely quieter out here, away from strife-torn Ashton. Still, neither one felt entirely comfortable about the two passengers in the car below. Although the heavenly escorts weren't yet certain, they had a feeling that a covert plot on the part of Rayfar and his guerrillas might be underway. Marshall and his good-looking young reporter were too critical a combination for those devils to pass up. Former college dean Eldon Strawn lived on a quaint and unpretentious 10-acre farm an hour away from Ashton. He was not farming the place, just living there. And as Marshall and Bernice drove up the long gravel driveway, they could tell his interests extended no further than the immediate yard of the white farmhouse. The lawn was small and manicured, the fruit trees pruned and bearing, the flower beds soft with freshly turned and weeded soil. Some chickens meandered about, pecking and scratching. A collie greeted their approach with furious barking.
"Wow, a normal human being to interview for once," said Marshall.
"That's why he moved out of Ashton," said Bernice.
Strawn stepped onto his porch as the collie ran and barked beside him.
"Hi there," he called to Marshall and Bernice as they got out of the car.
"Quiet now, lady," he called to the collie. Lady never obeyed such commands.
Strawn was a healthy, white-haired fellow who got plenty of exercise on this place and showed it. He wore work clothes and still carried a pair of garden gloves in his hand. Marshall extended his hand for a good firm handshake. So did Bernice. They exchanged introductions, and then Strawn invited them around the barking lady and into the house.
"Doris," Strawn called, "Mr. Hogan and Miss Kruger are here."
Within minutes, Doris, a sweet and rotund little grandma type, had set the coffee table with tea, coffee, rolls, and goodies. And they were having a pleasant conversation about the farm, the countryside, the weather, the neighbor's wandering cow. They all knew it was obligatory, and besides, the Strawns were very pleasant people to talk and visit with. Finally, Eldon Strawn introduced the transitional sentence.
"Yes, I suppose things in Ashton aren't quite this nice."
Bernice got out her notepad as Marshall said,
"Yeah, and I kind of hate to drag it all out here with us."
Strawn smiled and said philosophically,
"You can run, but you can't hide."
He looked out the window at the trees backed by endless blue sky and said,
"I've always wondered if just leaving it all was the right thing. But what else could I do?"
Marshall double-checked his notes.
"Let's see now. You told me on the phone when you left in late June, about a year ago, and Ralph Kuklinski took your place. And he's still there, I understand." "Yeah, still there." "Was he in on any of this inner circle stuff? I don't know what else to call it."
Strawn thought for a moment.
"I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was. He really had to be one of the group to be put in as dean." "So there really is some kind of in-group, so to speak." "Absolutely. That became pretty obvious after a while. All the regents were becoming like peas in a pod, like clones of each other. They all acted the same, talked the same, except for you."
Strawn laughed a little.
"I guess I just didn't fit into the club very well. As a matter of fact, I became a definite outsider, even an enemy. And I think that's why they fired me."
"I suppose you're talking about that fracas over the college funds."
"Exactly."
Strawn had to resift his memory.
I never suspected anything until we started having some unexplained disbursement delays. Our bills were being paid late. Our payrolls were behind. It wasn't even my job to be hounding after that sort of thing, but when I started getting some indirect complaints, you know, hearing others talking about it, I asked Baylor what the problem was. He never directly answered my questions, or at least I didn't like the sound of his answers. That's when I asked an independent accountant, a friend of a friend, to look into it and maybe do some quick scanning of what the accounting office was doing. I don't know how he ever got access to the information, but he was a clever character, and he found a way.
Bernice was ready with a question. Can we have his name? Strawn answered with a shrug.
Johnson. Ernie Johnson.
How do we reach him?
I'm afraid he's dead.
That was a letdown. Marshall grabbed at a hope.
Did he leave you any records, anything written down?
Strawn only shook his head.
If he did, those records were lost. Why do you think I've been sitting out here so silently? Listen, I even know Norm Mattily, the state attorney general, pretty well, and I thought of going to him and telling him what was going on. But let's face it, those big folks at the top don't give you the time of day unless you really have some substantial proof. It's tough to get the authorities to stick their necks out. They just won't do it.
All right. So, what was it that Ernie Johnson found?
He came back horrified. According to his findings, monies from grants and tuitions were being reinvested at an alarming rate. But apparently there were no dividends or returns of any kind from whatever the investments were, as if the money had been poured down a bottomless well somewhere. The figures had been juggled to cover it up. Accounts payable had been staggered so that no other accounts could be dipped into to pay those due. It was just one colossal mess.
A mess worth millions?
At least. The college money had been leaking out in large amounts for years, with no clues as to where it was going. Somewhere out there was a money-hungry monster gobbling up all the college's assets.
And that's when you called for the audit.
And Eugene Baylor hit the ceiling. The whole thing went from professional to personal in an instant, and we became intense enemies. And that convinced me all the more that the college was in big trouble and that Baylor had a lot to do with it. But, of course, there's nothing Baylor does that all the others don't know about. I'm sure they're all aware of the problem, and it's my feeling that their unanimous vote for my resignation was a common conspiracy.
But to what end? Asked Bernice. Why would they want to undermine the college's financial base?
Strawn could only shake his head. I don't know what they're trying to do. But unless there's something else hidden somewhere to explain where these funds are going and how the losses are going to be made up, that college is most certainly headed for bankruptcy. Kuklinski must know that. As far as I know, he was in total agreement with the financial policies and with my resignation.
Marshall flipped to some other notes.
So, just how does our kind Professor Langstrat figure into all this?
Strawn had to chuckle.
Oh, the dear professor.
He considered the question for a moment.
She was always a definite influence and mentor, to be sure. But I don't think she's the ultimate center of things. It seemed to me that she had a lot to do with controlling the group, while someone higher up had a lot to do with controlling her. I think she's answering to someone, some unseen authority.
But you've no idea who.
Strawn shook his head.
So, what else do you know about her?
Strawn searched his memory.
A graduate of UCLA. She taught at other universities before she came to Whitmore. She's been on the faculty for at least 6 years. I do recall that she always had a strong interest in Eastern philosophy and occultism. She was once involved in some kind of neo-pagan religious group in California. But, you know, I never realized until maybe 3 years ago that she was openly declaring her beliefs to her classes, and I was rather surprised to find that her teachings had aroused a lot of interest. Her beliefs and practices were not only spreading among the students, but also among the faculty.
"Who on the faculty?" Marshall asked.
Strawn shook his head in disgust.
"It started years before I was aware of it, in the psychology department, among Langstrat's associates. Margaret Islander, you may know of her."
"I believe my friend Ruth Williams does," said Bernice.
"I think she was the first to be initiated into Langstrat's group, but she'd always had an interest in psychics like Edgar Cayce, so she was a natural."
"Anyone else?" Marshall prodded.
Strawn pulled out a hastily scrawled list and let Marshall have a look at it.
"I've gone over and over this in the months since I left. Here's a list of most of the psychology department."
He pointed out a few names.
"Trevor Corcoran is new on the staff this year. He even studied in India before he came here to teach. Juanita Janke replaced Kevin Ford. Well, as a matter of fact, a lot of people were replaced over the past few years. We had a lot of turnover."
Marshall noted another portion of the list.
"So who are these people?"
"The humanities department, and then the philosophy department, and these down here are in the biology and pre-med programs. A lot of them are new as well. We had a lot of turnover."
"That's the second time you've said that," Bernice observed. Strawn stared at her.
"What are you thinking?"
Bernice took the list from Marshall and placed it in front of Strawn again.
"Well, tell us now, how many of these people have come on staff during the last 6 years, during the time Langstrat's been there?"
Strawn took a second, more critical look at the list.
"Jones, Conrad, Witherspoon, Epps."
An overwhelming percentage of the names were those of new faculty members, who had replaced former members who had resigned or whose contracts had simply not been renewed.
"Well, isn't that odd?"
"I would say that's odd," Bernice agreed.
Strawn was visibly shaken.
"All the turnover. I was getting very concerned about it, but I never even considered. This would explain a lot of things. I knew there was some kind of common interest spreading among all these people. They all seemed to have a very unique and undefinable rapport with each other. Their own lingo, their own inside secrets, their own ideas of reality. It seemed no one person could do anything without everyone else knowing about it. I thought it was a fad, a sociological phase."
He looked up from the list with a new awareness in his eyes.
"So, it was more than that. Our campus was invaded and our faculty displaced by a madness."
For just a moment, Marshall had a flashback, a quick, fleeting memory of his daughter Sandy saying,
"People around here are starting to act weird. I think we're being invaded by aliens."
That memory was immediately followed by Kate's voice over the phone.
"I'm concerned about Sandy. She just isn't the same old Sandy anymore."
Marshall snapped out of it and began leafing through his materials. He finally found the old list Bernice had gotten from Albert Darr.
"All right, what about these classes Langstrat was teaching? Introduction to God and Goddess Consciousness and the Craft? The Sacred Medicine Wheel? Spells and Rituals? Pathways to Your Inner Light? Meet Your Own Spiritual Guides?"
Strawn nodded with recognition.
"It all began as part of an alternative education program. Purely a voluntary thing for any interested students paid for by special tuitions. I just thought it was a study of folklore, myths, traditions.
But I guess they were taking this stuff pretty seriously."
So it seems. And now we have a great percentage of the staff and the student body bewitched."
"Including the regents?"
Strawn did some fresh thinking.
Get ready for this. I think the same kind of upheaval happened on the Board of Regents as well. There are 12 regent positions altogether, and 5, I think, have been suddenly and abruptly replaced in the last year and a half. How else could the vote for my resignation be unanimous? I used to have some very loyal friends on that board.
What are their names, and where have they gone?
Bernice started writing the names down as Strawn recalled them, along with any other information he could provide about each person. Jake Abernathy had died, Morris James had gone bankrupt in a business and moved to another job, Fred Ainsworth, George Olson, and Rita Jacobson had all left Ashton with no word as to where they had gone.
"And that," said Strawn, "takes care of just about everyone. There are none left but initiates into this strange mystical group."
"Including Kuklinski, the new dean," Bernice added.
"And Dwight Brandon, the owner of the land."
"And what about Ted Harmel?" Marshall asked.
Strawn tightened his lips, looked at the floor, and sighed.
"Yes, he did try to back out, but by then they'd already entrusted too much information to him. When they found they couldn't control him any more, he has myself and our friendship to blame for that. They arranged to defame him and chase him out of town with that ridiculous scandal."
"Hmm," said Bernice. "A conflict of interest."
"Of course. He kept telling me it was a fascinating new science of the human mind, and he claimed he was only after a story. But he just kept getting more and more wrapped up in it, and they wooed him, I'm sure. I heard him say that they had promised him great success with his newspaper because he had aligned himself with them."
Marshall had another flashback. He saw Brummel looking at him with those numbing gray eyes, saying sweetly,
"Marshall, we'd like to know that you'll be standing with us."
Strawn was still talking. Marshall woke up and said,
excuse me, what was that again?
"Oh," said Strawn, "I was just saying that Ted became torn between two loyalties. First and foremost, he was loyal to the truth and to his friends, and that included me. His other loyalty was to the Langstrat group and their philosophies and practices. I guess he thought that the truth was inviolable and the press would always be free. But whatever the reason, he began to print stories about the financial problems, and that was definitely stepping over the line as far as the regents were concerned."
"Yes," Bernice recalled. "Now I remember him saying they were trying to control him and dictate what he printed. He was really mad about it."
"Well, of course," said Strawn. "But it came down to principles, regardless of what so-called science or metaphysical philosophies he may have been interested in. Ted was still a newspaper man and would not be intimidated."
Strawn sighed and looked at the floor.
"So I'm afraid he got caught in the crossfire of my battle with the college regents. Consequently, we both lost our positions, our good standing in the community, everything. I guess you could say I was well content to leave it all behind. It was impossible to fight it."
Marshall disliked that kind of talk.
Is this thing really that strong?"
Strawn was deadly serious.
"I don't think I ever realized how vast and strong it really was, and I guess I'm still finding out. Mr. Hogan, I have no idea what the final goal of these people is, but I'm beginning to see that nothing standing in their way can escape being stamped out, eliminated. Even as we sit here, I can look back over the years, and not even considering our faculty turnover, I'm frightened to think of how many other people around Ashton have just dropped out of sight."
Joe, the supermarket owner, Marshall thought.
"And what about Edie?"
Strawn was looking a little pale now and asked with obvious worry in his voice,
"Just what do you people intend to do with this information?"
Marshall had to be honest.
"I don't know yet. There are too many missing pieces, too many assumptions. I don't have anything I can print.
You do remember what happened to Ted. You are keeping that in mind.
Marshall didn't want to think about that. He wanted to find out something else.
Ted wouldn't talk to me.
He's scared.
Scared of what?
Of them. Of the system that destroyed him. He knows more about their weird goings-on than I do. He knows enough to be a lot more afraid than I am, and I believe his fears are justified. I do believe there's a genuine danger here.
Well, does he ever talk to you?
Sure. About anything besides what you're after.
But the two of you are in touch.
Yes. We fish, we hunt, we meet for lunch. He isn't far from here.
Could you call him?
You mean call him and put in a plug for you?
That's exactly what I mean.
Strawn answered cautiously.
Hey, he may not want to talk, and I can't push him.
But will you just call him? See if he'll talk to me one more time.
I'll think about it. But that's all I can promise you.
I'd appreciate even that.
But, Mr. Hogan...
Strawn reached over and grabbed Marshall's arm. He looked at both Marshall and Bernice and said very quietly,
"You people watch out for yourselves. You're not invincible. None of the rest of us were, and I believe it's possible to lose everything if you make just one wrong move or take just one wrong step. Please, please be sure at every moment you know exactly what you're doing."
At the Clarion, Tom, the paste-up man, was getting the usual ads, fillers, and completed galleys into the Tuesday edition when the bell over the front door jingled. He had better things to do than deal with callers, but with Hogan and Bernice out on their mysterious mission of intrigue, he was the only remaining fort-holder downer. Boy, he wished Edie had stuck around. The paper got to be more of a shambles every day, and whatever wild goose chase Hogan and Bernice were on, it took their attention away from the many tasks piling up around the place.
"Hello?"
called a woman's sweet voice. Tom grabbed a shop cloth to wipe his hands and hollered back,
"Hold on, I'm coming."
He scurried up the narrow passage to the front office and saw a very attractive and neatly dressed young woman standing at the counter. She smiled when she saw him. Ah, yes, thought Tom, if I were only young again.
"Hello there,"
he said, still wiping his hands on the shop cloth.
"What can I do for you?"
The young lady said,
"I read your ad for a secretary and general office manager. I've come to apply."
It had to be an angel, Tom thought.
"Boy, if you can cut it, let me tell you there's sure a job to be had around here."
"Well, I'm ready to start,"
she said with a bright smile. Tom made sure his hand was clean enough and then extended it.
"Tom McBride, paste-up man and general worrier."
She shook his hand firmly and said her name.
"Carmen."
"Pleased to meet you, Carmen." "Carmen who?"
She laughed at her lapse of mind and said,
"Oh, Carmen Frazier. I get so used to just going by my first name."
Tom swung the little gate open at the end of the counter, and Carmen followed him into the office area.
"Let me show you what the devil's going on here," he said.
Chapter 17. In the faraway secluded valley, in the little cluster of unlabeled buildings hidden by rocky crags, a hurried transition was in full swing. In the office complex, sitting at desks and work tables, scurrying up and down the aisles, dashing in and out the doors, running up and down the stairways, over 200 people of all ages, descriptions, and nationalities were typing letters, going through files, checking records, balancing accounts, chattering on telephones in different languages. Maintenance people in blue coveralls brought in large stacks of boxes and crates on hand trucks, and the office workers meticulously began to fill the boxes with the contents of the file cabinets, with any office paraphernalia not immediately needed, with other books and records. Outside, trucks were being loaded with the crates as more maintenance people driving little grounds tractors went about the complex.
shutting down various hookups and utilities and boarding up any buildings no longer occupied. Nearby, on the porch of the big stone house at the edge of the grounds, a woman stood watching. She was tall and slender, with long jet-black hair. She wore black, loose-fitting clothes, and she clutched her shoulder bag close to her side with pale, trembling hands. She looked this way and that, evidently trying to relax herself. She took a few deep breaths. She reached into her bag and brought out a pair of dark sunglasses with which she covered her eyes. Then she stepped down from the porch and started across the plaza toward the office building. Her steps were firm and deliberate. Her eyes remained straight ahead. A few office personnel passed and saluted her, pressing their palms together in front of their chins and bowing slightly. She nodded at them and kept walking. The office staff saluted her in the same way as she entered, and she smiled at them, not speaking a word. Upon receiving her smile, they returned to their feverish work. The office manager, a well-dressed woman with tightly pinned hair, stepped up, gave a slight bow, and said, "Good morning. What does the maidservant require?" The maidservant smiled and said, "I'd like to run off some copies."
"I can do it immediately."
"Thank you. I'd like to run them off myself."
"Certainly. I'll warm up the machine for you."
The woman scurried toward a small room off to the side, and the maidservant followed. Several accountants and filing clerks, some Oriental, some East Indian, some European, bowed as she passed and then went back to their consultations with each other. The office manager had the copier ready in less than a minute.
"Thank you. You may go now," said the maidservant. "Certainly," answered the woman. "I am at your disposal if you have any problems or questions."
"Thank you." The manager left, and the maidservant closed the door behind her, shutting out the rest of the office and any intrusions. Then quickly, the maidservant reached into her bag and brought out a small book. She leafed through it, skimming over the handwritten pages until she found what she was looking for. Then, laying the book open and face down on the copier, she started pressing the buttons and copying page after page. 40 pages later, she turned off the machine, folded the copies neatly, and placed them in a compartment of her bag along with the little book. She left the office directly and went back to the big stone house. The house was majestic in its size and decor, with a large stone hearth and soaring, rough-beamed ceilings. The maidservant hurried up the thickly carpeted staircase to her bedroom and closed the door behind her. Placing the little book on her stately antique vanity, she opened a drawer and pulled out some brown wrapping paper and twine. The paper already had a name written on it, the addressee, Alexander M. Kasif. The return address included the name J. Langstrat. She quickly rewrapped the book as if it had never been opened, then bound the package with string. Elsewhere in the house, in a very large office, a middle-aged, roundly built man dressed in loose trousers and tunic sat Indian fashion on a large cushion. His eyes were closed, his breathing deep. The fine furnishings of a man of great prestige and power surrounded him. Souvenirs from around the world, such as swords, war clubs, African artifacts, religious relics, and several rather grotesque idols of the East. A battleship of a desk with built-in computer console, multi-line telephone, and an intercom. A long, deep-cushioned couch with matching hand-carved oak chairs and coffee table. Hunting trophies of bear, elk, moose, and lion. Without hearing a knock, the man spoke loftily. "Come in, Susan." The big oak door opened silently, and the maidservant entered, carrying the brown paper package. Without opening his eyes, the man said, "Put it on my desk." The maidservant did so, and the man began to stir from his motionless position, opening his eyes and stretching his arms as if awakening from sleep.
"So you finally found it," he said with a teasing smile.
"It was there all the time. With all the packing and rearranging, it got shoved over in the corner."
The man rose from his cushion, stretched his legs, and walked a few laps around the office.
"I really don't know what it is," he said as if answering a question.
"I didn't wonder," said the maidservant.
He smiled condescendingly and said, "Oh, maybe not, but it felt like you did." He went up behind her and placed his hands on her shoulders, speaking in her ear. "Sometimes I can read you so very well, and sometimes you drift away. You've been feeling so troubled lately. Why?"
"Oh, all the moving, I guess, the upheaval."
He put his arms around her waist and held her close as he said, "Don't let it bother you. We're going to a far better place. I have a house all picked out. You'll love it."
"I grew up in that town, you know."
"No, no, not really. It won't be the same town at all, not as you remember it. It will be better. But you don't believe that, do you?"
"As I said, I grew up in Ashton."
"And all you wanted was to get out of there.
So you can understand why my feelings are confused."
He twirled her around and laughed playfully as he looked into her eyes. "Yes, I know. On the one hand, you have no desire at all for the town, and on the other hand, you sneak off to attend the carnival." She blushed a little and looked at the floor.
"I was searching for something from my past, something from which to envision my future."
He held her hand and said, "There is no past. You should have stayed with me. I hold the answers for you now."
"Yes, I can see that. I couldn't before."
He laughed and went behind his desk. "Well, good, good. We don't need any more meetings held in hiding places behind a noisy carnival. You should have seen how embarrassed our friends were to have to meet there."
"But why did you even have to come looking for me? Why did you have to drag them along?"
He sat at the desk and began handling a wicked-looking ceremonial knife with a golden handle and razor-sharp blade. Looking over the edge of the blade at her, he said, "Because, dear maidservant, I do not trust you. I love you. I am one in essence with you, but..." He held the knife up to the level of his eye and peered down the edge of the blade at her, his eyes as sharply cutting as the knife. "I do not trust you. You are a woman given to many conflicting passions."
"I cannot harm the plan. I am only one person among myriads."
He rose and came around to the side of the desk where other knives were stuck into the carved head of some pagan idol. "You, dear Susan, share my life, my secrets, my purposes. I have to protect my interests." With that, he dropped the knife point first, and it thudded into the idol's head. She smiled in acquiescence and sidled up to him, giving him an alluring kiss.
"I am... and will always be yours," she said.
He gave her a sly smile, and the cutting look never left his eyes as he answered, "Yes, of course you are." High above the valley, amid the rocks and crevices of the mountaintops, two figures concealed themselves. One, the silver-haired man who had been here before, continually watched the activity below. He was stately and mighty, his piercing eyes full of wisdom. The other was Tal, the captain of the host.
"This is what you're looking for," said the silver-haired man. "Raefar had business there only days ago."
Tal peered down into the valley. The swarms of black demons were too numerous to even estimate. "The strong man?" he asked.
"Undoubtedly. With a cloud of guards and warriors all around him. We've been unable to penetrate it yet."
"And she's right in the middle of it."
"The spirit has been steadily opening her eyes and calling her. She is close to the strong man, dangerously close. The prayers of the remnant have placed a blindness and stupor on the demonic hosts all around her. At present it will buy you time. But little more."
Tal grimaced.
"My general, it will take more than a stupor for us to break through to her. We can barely hold the town of Ashton, much less take on the strong man directly."
"And you can only expect this build-up to worsen. Their numbers increase tenfold each day.
Yes, they are preparing. That's for certain.
But at the same time, her conflicts continue to grow. Soon she won't be able to conceal her true feelings and intentions from her lord down there. Tal, she has learned of the suicide.
Tal looked directly at the general. I understand she and Patricia were very close.
The general nodded. It jolted her, which made her more receptive. But her time of safety is limited. Here's your next step. The Universal Consciousness Society is holding a special fundraising and promotional dinner in New York for its many cohorts and members in the United Nations. Kasef can't attend because of his present activities here. He will send Susan, however, to represent him. She'll be closely escorted, but this will be the one time she'll be out from under the strong man's demonic cover. The spirit knows she plans to get away and make contact with one remaining friend on the outside, who can in turn contact your newspaper man. She'll take that chance, Tal. You must arrange for her to succeed.
Tal's first response was, Is there prayer cover in New York?
You will have it.
Tal looked at the swarms below. And they must not find out.
No, they must not suspect anything has happened until you can get Susan out for good. They would destroy her if they knew.
And who is the friend?
His name is Kevin Weed, a former classmate and boyfriend.
To work, then. I have some more prayer to gather in.
Godspeed, dear Captain.
Tal climbed behind some large rocks for concealment before he unfurled his wings. Then, with the silence and grace of a drifting cloud, he floated up over the mountaintop. Once he had cleared the summit and could no longer be seen by any of the swarms in the valley, his wings snapped into a rushing pattern, and he shot forward like a bullet, trailing a brilliant arc of light across the sky and over the horizon. Marshall and Bernice drove through the forested countryside in the big brown Buick, talking about themselves, their pasts, their families, and anything else that came to mind. They were getting tired of only talking about business anyway, and finding it enjoyable to share each other's company.
I grew up Presbyterian, said Marshall. Now I don't know what I am.
My folks were Episcopalian, said Bernice. I don't think I was ever anything. They dragged me along to church every Sunday, and I couldn't wait to get out of there.
I didn't mind it that much. I had a good Sunday school teacher.
Yeah, maybe that's where I missed out. I never went to Sunday school.
Oh, I think a kid needs to know something about God.
What if God doesn't exist?
See what I mean? You never went to Sunday school.
The Buick came to a crossroads, and a sign indicated the way back to Ashton was to the left. Marshall turned left. Bernice answered one of Hogan's questions.
Nope, no parents alive anymore. Dad died in 76, and Mom died, let's see, 2 years ago.
That's too bad.
And then I lost my only sibling, Patricia.
Is that right? Boy, I'm sorry.
It's a lonely world out there sometimes.
Yeah, I suppose. And I wonder who there is to meet in Ashton.
She only looked at him and said, I'm not hunting, Marshall. About a mile ahead of them was a wide spot in the road referred to as Baker, a little town indicated by the smallest possible dot on the map. It was one of those typical roadsides where truckers and four-wheeling hunters drop in for black coffee and cold eggs. Blink just once and you'd miss it. Above the Buick, whisking just over the tops of the trees, Nathan and Armoth kept a careful eye on the vehicle, their wings rushing in an even pattern and their bodies trailing two streaks of diamond-studded light.
So this is where it all begins, said Nathan with a playful tone. And you have been chosen to strike the blow, responded Armoth.
Nathan smiled. Child's play. Armoth teased him a little. I'm sure Tal could pick someone else who would like the honor.
Nathan drew his sword, and it flashed like a lightning bolt. "Oh, no, dear Armoth, I've waited long enough. I'll take it." Nathan banked away from Armoth, dropped down over the roadway as it wound through the tall